Hello.
Senator Russell, 2191.
Just a moment.
Dick?
Yes?
I hate to bother you again, but...
All right, Mr. Burdick.
I want you to know that I made an announcement.
Well, announcement of what?
Of this special commission.
Right.
May I read it to you? The President announced that he is appointing a special commission to study and report upon all the facts and circumstances relating to the assassination of the late President John F. Kennedy and the subsequent violent death of the man charged with the assassination. The members of the special commission are, Chief Justice Earl Warren, Chairman, Senator Richard Russell, Georgia, Senator John Cooper, Kentucky, Representative Hale Boggs, Louisiana, Representative Gerald Ford, Michigan, Honorable Allen Dulles, Washington, Honorable John J. McCloy, New York.
That's President Lyndon Johnson. It's the night of November the 29th, 1963, exactly a week after the Kennedy assassination, and Johnson has just put together a seven-man presidential commission to investigate the crime. The commission will be chaired by Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and before long, everyone will be calling it the Warren Commission. To begin with, Lyndon Johnson had been reluctant to set up a special presidential inquiry. J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was working on its own supposedly definitive report about the assassination. Hoover kept telling Johnson that this report was almost complete, and Johnson had promised the American public that he would release the report as soon as it was done. But in Washington, rumors were starting to circulate that at least two separate committees of Congress were preparing to launch their own assassination inquiries. It was starting to look as if there might be a whole bunch of competing investigations, some of which would have the bad smell of party politics hanging over them. Johnson's aides had urged him to head off this nightmare scenario by setting up his own presidential inquiry. This would be a blue-ribbon affair with equal representation from both sides of politics and both chambers of Congress, and it would shut down all the other inquiries before they could even start. By the morning of Friday the 29th, Johnson had decided that his advisers were right. By lunchtime that day, he'd put together a wish list of the seven men he wanted on his commission. Besides Chief Justice Warren, the men Johnson wanted were Allen Dulles, the former director of the CIA, John McCloy, the former president of the World Bank, and four members of Congress, two from the Senate and two from the House. From the House, he wanted the Republican Gerald Ford and the Democrat Hale Boggs, and from the Senate, he wanted the Democrat Richard Russell and the Republican Sherman Cooper. At 1:20 that afternoon, Johnson asked his national security adviser, McGeorge Bundy, to write down those seven names so he wouldn't forget them.
All right, Mac, write those names down for me so I won't forget them. We'll have the Chief Justice, John McCloy, and Allen Dulles. We'll try to get Jerry Ford as Republican and Hale Boggs as Democrat in the House. We'll try to get Russell and Cooper.
Yes.
So that was Johnson's wish list as of 1:20 p.m. that day. He still hadn't confirmed that any of the men on his wish list were willing to serve, but when he announced the formation of the Warren Commission at 7 o'clock that night, all seven of the men he just named were on it. This shouldn't surprise us because Johnson was not a man who was into taking no for an answer. In fact, when one of the men on his wish list did give Johnson no for an answer, Johnson simply ignored him and put him on the commission anyway. That man was Senator Dick Russell, Johnson's close friend and former mentor. Dick Russell hated Earl Warren's guts, and he told Johnson that there was no way he was going to serve on any commission that Warren was the chairman of. But later that night, Johnson rang Dick Russell up and told him that he'd just announced the lineup of the commission, and one of the names he'd announced was Russell's, so Russell was just going to have to suck it up and do his duty. Here's some audio from that fairly brutal phone call.
Dick has already been announced, and you can serve with anybody for the good of America, and you can do anything for your country, and don't go to give me that kind of stuff about you can't serve with anybody. You can do anything.
It's not only that. I have never...
You never turned your country down?
At could.
Well, this is not me. This is your country. And you're my man on that commission, and you're going to do it. And don't tell me what you can do and what you can't, because I can't arrest you, and I'm not going to put the FBI on you, but you're goddamn sure going to serve, I'll tell you that.
You've had to beg me. You've always told me.
No, I haven't, no. No, I haven't.
I don't, Mr. President, please now.
No, it's already done. It's been announced, hell.
You mean you've given that?
Yes, sir. I mean, I gave it. I gave the announcement. It's already in the papers, and you're on it, and you're going to be my man on it.
And that's how Lyndon Johnson spoke to his friends. But there was one man in America that he didn't dare speak to like that. As Johnson prepared to announce the formation of the Warren Commission, he still hadn't broken the news about it to J. Edgar Hoover. And Hoover wasn't going to like hearing it. My name is David Free, and this is The Ghosts of Dallas. When Lyndon Johnson telephoned J. Edgar Hoover that Friday to break the news about the Warren Commission, it was 1:40 in the afternoon. In less than 6 hours, Johnson would be announcing the formation of the Warren Commission to the press. The text of his announcement was already being drafted. The commission was going to happen, whether J. Edgar Hoover liked it or not. But Johnson didn't put it that way to Hoover. Hoover was a touchy and dangerous old man, and he had to be handled with care. He was generally agreed to be the second most powerful man in America, just behind Johnson himself. And unlike Johnson, Hoover couldn't be voted out of office. He'd been the director of the FBI for 39 years now, since 1924. He was 68 years old, and he was showing clear signs of mental decline. He was known to keep detailed dirt files on his enemies, and he had a habit of using his agents to monitor and harass people he considered politically undesirable, such as Martin Luther King. Hoover was a scary and almost dictatorial figure, and even the generally fearless Lyndon Johnson was wary of him. When somebody asked Johnson years later why he never simply fired Hoover, Johnson said, "It's better to have him inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in." So when Johnson telephoned Hoover to tell him about the formation of the Warren Commission, he broke the news gently and gradually. He began by making it sound as if his decision hadn't quite been made yet. He also made it sound as if the idea wasn't exactly his. It was more an idea that other people were kicking around.
Are you familiar with this proposed group that they're trying to put together on this study of your report and other things, two from the House, two from the Senate, somebody in the court, a couple of outsiders?
No, I haven't heard of that. I've seen the reports on the Senate Investigating Committee that they've been talking about.
Yeah, well, we think if we don't have, I want to get by just with your filing your report.
I think it would be very, very bad to have a rash of investigations.
Well, the only way we can stop them is probably to appoint a high level one to evaluate your report.
Yeah.
And put somebody that's pretty good on it from that I can select out of the government and tell the House and Senate not to go ahead with the investigation.
Yes.
Because we get up there and get a bunch of television going, and I thought it'd be bad.
It'd be a three-ring circus.
It'd be a three-ring circus, is what Hoover said there at the end. Hoover had a way of speaking in rapid-fire bursts, because he'd had a stutter as a child, and this was his way of getting around it. As for Lyndon Johnson, you have to admire the crafty way he was framing his presidential commission to Hoover. Johnson made it sound as if the commission would be a simple formality. He made it sound as if the FBI's assassination report would still be at the center of things. The commission wouldn't be conducting a rival investigation of Kennedy's murder. It would just be reading the FBI's report and giving it a quick rubber stamp. After selling Hoover on those points, Johnson then pretended to seek his advice about who he should put on the commission, even though he'd already finalized his 7-man wish list around 20 minutes earlier.
I don't know know you know anything, any reason. Just talking, me and you are going to talk like brothers. Yeah, no.
Me and you are going to talk like brothers, Johnson said there. In that brotherly spirit, he started running the names of a few potential commissioners past Hoover, but he was careful to skip the name of Earl Warren because he knew that Hoover wasn't a fan. Instead, he led with the much safer names of Alan Dulles and John McCloy.
What do you think about Alan Dulles?
I think he would be a good man.
What do you think about John McCloy?
I'm not as enthusiastic about McCloy. He's a good man, but I'm not so certain as to the matter of the publicity that he might seek on it.
Unfortunately for Hoover, John McCloy was going to be on the commission anyway, whether he liked it or not. To throw Hoover a bone, Johnson then mentioned the name of Senator Jacob Javits, a guy who he had no real intention of putting on the commission, so that Hoover could have the illusion that he was vetoing him.
I wouldn't want Javits or some of those off on it.
Javits plays to the front page
cover to cover.
Javits plays to the front page all the time, Hoover said. Hoover had objected to John McCloy for the same reason, because he was a publicity seeker. As we're going to see, it was outrageous of J. Edgar Hoover to complain about the publicity-seeking habits of other public officials, because Hoover had a gargantuan appetite for publicity himself, and his desperate need to put the FBI at the front and centre of the assassination story would end up deepening the public confusion about Kennedy's murder and feeding the rise of conspiracy theory. Right from the start, Hoover set out to sabotage the Warren Commission, and his campaign was sadly effective. In fact, Hoover's treachery would have disastrous long-term effects on the public's understanding of the Kennedy assassination. If we still have trouble seeing the case straight today, J. Edgar Hoover is one of the key historical villains we can thank for that. Hoover's sabotage campaign against the Warren Commission started almost as soon as this telephone call with President Johnson was over. But during the phone call itself, Hoover had no choice but to behave himself. He knew his place. He knew that he couldn't flat out tell Johnson not to establish his presidential commission at all, even though he desperately didn't want him to. But why did Hoover find the idea of a presidential commission so abhorrent? There are several answers to that question, which range from the obvious to the very well hidden. To start with the obvious, Hoover had a grossly inflated opinion of himself and the FBI. Kennedy's assassination was the most significant murder in modern American history, and in Hoover's mind, the FBI was the natural candidate to solve the crime. The FBI's investigation was the be-all and the end-all, as far as Hoover was concerned. And as he'd told Johnson several times before, that investigation was now very close to complete. In fact, he assured Johnson of that again during this same phone call.
We hope to have this thing wrapped up today, but we probably won't get it before the first of the week. This angle in Mexico is giving us a great deal of trouble.
We hoped to have this thing wrapped up today, Hoover said. Just a week after Kennedy's murder, this was an astounding thing to say. The idea that something as significant and complicated as Kennedy's murder could be wrapped up in a week was close to delusional. As we're going to see, the Warren Commission would take 9.5 months to conduct its investigation of the crime, but Hoover was talking as if a week was almost enough. Since the moment of Kennedy's assassination, Hoover's overriding priority was to conduct a speedy investigation as opposed to a thorough one. Right from the start, he'd been telling his agents to, quote, do it fast. Hoover was desperate to get the FBI's final report into the public domain as soon as possible. The sooner it was out there, the less likely it would be that other government agencies would get any big ideas about starting their own investigations. Also, Hoover was well aware of the alarming and subversive conspiracy theories that had immediately started to spring up after Kennedy's murder, and he seemed to think it was his personal duty to squash those conspiracy theories. Hoover seemed to think of himself as America's big brother. On the afternoon of November the 24th, just 2.5 hours after Jack Ruby shot Oswald, Hoover dictated a memo that said, quote, "The thing I am concerned about is having something issued so we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin." Again, it was ridiculous for any so-called investigator to be saying that just a couple of hours after Oswald's death. At that time, it was way too early to know for sure that Oswald had been the real assassin, or that he'd acted alone. These were precisely the questions that any serious investigation was going to have to look into. But Hoover seemed to think that reassuring the public that Oswald had acted alone was somehow more important than establishing whether or not he had acted alone. Conspiracy theorists are fond of saying that there was a rush to judgment in the Kennedy case. In fact, the first bestseller about the case was called exactly that, Rush to Judgment. As we're going to see, it's ridiculously untrue to say that the Warren Commission rushed to judgment. A 9.5-month investigation is not a rush to anything. Unfortunately, though, it's impossible to deny that the FBI's initial investigation of the crime was a rush job. And that meant that the FBI made a lot of mistakes, as people always do when they're in a rush. The last thing the case needed, on top of its real complications, was the needless complications created by a shoddy investigation. But that's exactly the effect that J. Edgar Hoover's egomania ended up having on the assassination story. Besides his general urge to be the top dog on the Kennedy case, Hoover had a more specific and more sinister reason for not wanting to have any presidential commission poking around in the FBI's affairs. Back on the night of Kennedy's assassination, the Dallas police chief Jesse Curry had held a press conference, and he'd made some alarming remarks about Oswald and the FBI. And these remarks had put J. Edgar Hoover on a state of high alert.
I'm sorry, there's too many talking. I can't understand.
This man's apparent subversive background, was there any surveillance? Were police aware of his presence in Dallas?
We and the police department here did not know he was in Dallas. I understand the FBI did know that he was in Dallas.
Chief, it's not normally chief, sort of practice for the FBI to inform the police, municipal
yes.
police department.
Chief, do you have...
We did not have...
But you were not informed.
We had not been informed of this man.
What Chief Curry suggested there on the night of the assassination was that the FBI had been aware of Oswald's presence in Dallas and had possibly even had him under surveillance there, and yet had failed to notify the Dallas Police Department about that. If that was true, it made the FBI look dangerously incompetent, given that Oswald had just blown away the President of the United States. When J. Edgar Hoover heard what Chief Curry had said, he hit the roof. He told Curry that Oswald had not been under FBI surveillance in Dallas, and he bullied him into publicly retracting what he'd said. So Curry reluctantly told the press that his statement had been incorrect, even though it was true, and Curry knew it to be true, because on the afternoon of the assassination, an FBI agent based in Dallas had told one of Curry's lieutenants, quote, "We knew Oswald was capable of assassinating the president, but we didn't think he'd do it." The FBI agent who had let this terrible admission slip was a guy named James Hostie. And James Hostie knew what he was talking about because he was the FBI man who'd been assigned to monitor Oswald's activities in Dallas. At the time, Hostie had seen it as a fairly routine surveillance mission. Oswald wasn't on the FBI's radar because they knew about any of his recent shenanigans, such as his attempt to assassinate General Edwin Walker. They were watching him purely because he was a returned defector to the Soviet Union. So Agent Hostie wasn't monitoring Oswald's activities in Dallas all that closely. In fact, when the assassination occurred, Hostie still hadn't managed to arrange a face-to-face meeting with Oswald, but he had paid two visits to Oswald's wife, Marina, in the suburb of Irving. When Oswald found out about that, around 10 days before the assassination, he went to the FBI office in Dallas and dropped off an angry note addressed to Agent Hostie. This note hasn't survived, so we don't know for sure what it said, But a secretary at the FBI office who claimed to have read the note said later that it contained a threat to blow up the FBI's Dallas office if Hostie didn't stop harassing Marina. Hostie himself would claim that the note had been much less dramatic than that. He said that Oswald had just vaguely threatened that there would be consequences if Hostie didn't lay off. Anyway, whatever Oswald's note said, it offered hard proof that the FBI had been watching Oswald before the assassination and knew that he was an angry ratbag, but still had said nothing about him to the Secret Service or the Dallas Police Department when Kennedy came to town. All this looked very bad for the FBI, or rather, it would look bad if it ever got out. But the FBI did its best to make sure that it never would. On the afternoon of Oswald's death, the Dallas FBI chief called Agent Hostie into his office. He told Hostie that since Oswald was now dead and there was never going to be any trial, there was no longer any legal reason to keep Oswald's note, so Hostie had better now get rid of it. So Hostie ripped the note into pieces and flushed it down a toilet. In the offices of the Dallas FBI, it was generally believed that the order to destroy Oswald's note must have come from J. Edgar Hoover himself. The agents in Dallas found it inconceivable that their local boss would have ordered the destruction of such an important piece of evidence without Hoover's knowledge and approval. And even if Hoover didn't have direct knowledge of Oswald's note, this was certainly the kind of embarrassing stuff that he feared would come out if a presidential commission started digging around in the FBI's affairs. Never before in the 55-year history of the FBI had one of the Bureau's investigations been scrutinized by any outside agency. Hoover was opposed to this happening on principle, and he also had some very specific fears about what an independent investigation might discover. That's why he tried so hard to rush out a report that would make a presidential commission unnecessary. When that didn't work, and President Johnson established his commission anyway, Hoover adopted a fallback position. He made life as hard for the Warren Commission as he possibly could. He withheld information from it, and sometimes he outright lied to it. The commission never did find out about Oswald's threatening note to Agent Hostie, for example. That story didn't come out until 1975, when it was unearthed by a congressional committee. The irony of Hoover's paranoid attitude to the Warren Commission was that his paranoia turned out to be self-justifying. In his haste to outflank the commission, he caused his agents to make many more mistakes than they otherwise would have, which meant that when the Warren Commission did sit down to evaluate the FBI's investigation, they found exactly the kind of embarrassing gaffes that Hoover was afraid they would find. And Hoover's attempt to squash the emerging conspiracy theories about the case was equally self-defeating. Far from stopping the conspiracy theories, the FBI's hasty investigation created a huge storehouse of fake news and junk evidence that conspiracy theorists are still making a meal out of today. J. Edgar Hoover wanted to cut conspiracy theory off at the knees. Instead, he only succeeded in giving it wings. One of the basic assumptions that conspiracy theorists make about the Kennedy case is the assumption that all the official agencies involved, including the FBI, the Warren Commission, and the Dallas Police Department, all clubbed together in one giant chummy conspiracy to hide the truth from the American people. But as long as J. Edgar Hoover was running the FBI, the idea that the Bureau would happily put aside its own interests and serve as a team player in some giant harmonious conspiracy was a ridiculous fantasy. The truth is that Hoover's FBI went completely rogue after the Kennedy assassination. Hoover was outside the tent, so he did what he did when he was outside any tent. He pissed into it very thoroughly. One of the main weapons he used against the Warren Commission was the press leak. As soon as it became clear that the Warren Commission was going to happen, Hoover began aggressively leaking stories to the newspapers. These press leaks served several purposes. They kept the FBI at the centre of the assassination story, they kept affirming that Oswald was the lone assassin, and they undermined the authority of the Warren Commission. For example, just 4 days after President Johnson announced the commission's formation, a story issued by the Associated Press said that, quote, "An exhaustive FBI report now nearly ready for the White House will indicate that Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone and unaided assassin." 2 days after that story appeared in various newspapers around the country, the 7 members of the Warren Commission sat down for the first time to meet, and that newspaper story was one of the first things they discussed. Nobody at the meeting doubted that the story had been leaked by Hoover, and nobody doubted that Hoover was deliberately trying to undermine the commission's work. The acting Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach was present at the meeting as a representative of the Justice Department, and therefore the FBI. Dick Russell, the guy we heard getting strong-armed onto the commission at the beginning of this episode, confronted Katzenbach on the subject of the press leak. Russell said, quote, "How much of their findings does the FBI propose to release to the press before we present the findings of this commission?" Katzenbach replied that he'd already asked Hoover about the leak, and Hoover had flatly denied that it had come from the FBI. But Katzenbach also let the commission know that he wasn't dumb enough to believe Hoover's denial. "I say with candor to this committee," he said, "I can't think of anybody else it could have come from, because I don't know of anybody else who knew that information." Years later, when J. Edgar Hoover was safely dead, Katzenbach was even more candid about the source of the press leaks. "The Bureau constantly leaked things of this kind," he said. "When the Bureau leaked, it leaked as a formal matter. It was their form of press release." So right from the very first day of its existence, the Warren Commission found that the FBI had declared a kind of silent information war against it. And it wasn't hard to predict that Hoover's leaking campaign would continue and even intensify when the FBI's supposedly exhaustive report was complete. As Earl Warren said to Katzenbach before the Warren Commission's first meeting was over, "It would injure the work of this commission if those reports of the FBI or anyone else would be leaked out piecemeal." Warren obviously wanted Katzenbach to get this message back to Hoover, but it was hardly likely to do any good because injuring the work of the commission was precisely what Hoover was trying to do. So when the FBI report was done, its contents were indeed leaked out piecemeal to the press, just as Earl Warren had feared they would be. And the damage this did to the commission was even worse than Warren could have guessed, because the FBI's report contained a lot of information that was simply false. But because reporters considered the FBI to be an impeccable source, they faithfully reported its erroneous leaks as if they were the gospel truth. And as a result, the public's understanding of the Kennedy assassination was badly contaminated in those early days. Hundreds of thousands of people, including many conspiracy theorists, unknowingly built the mistakes of the FBI into their picture of what had happened in Dallas. This meant that when the Warren Commission finally published its report, which delivered a different but far more accurate picture of what had happened, it seemed to many people that the commission was making a crude attempt to rewrite history and whitewash the truth. So exactly how shoddy was the FBI's initial investigation of Kennedy's murder? The Bureau delivered its 5-volume assassination report to the White House on December the 9th, a little over 2 weeks after Kennedy's death. On the 16th of December, the Warren Commission met to discuss the contents of the FBI report. Each commissioner had received a copy, and they now had a week to look it over. The minutes of their meeting show us that as the commissioners gingerly began to discuss their impressions of the FBI report, it didn't take them long to to discover that they were all on the same page. The report was a turkey. "It's totally inconclusive," said Earl Warren. "This bullet business leaves me confused," said John McCloy. "It didn't have the depth that it ought to have," said Gerald Ford. "It leaves a million questions," said Hale Boggs. Lee Rankin, the Commission's chief counsel, said, "The report has so many holes in it. It just doesn't seem they're looking for things that this Commission has to look for in order to get the answers that it wants and it's entitled to." For good measure, John McCloy pointed out that even the grammar of the report was bad. And Earl Warren noted that the report seemed to dodge the key question of whether or not the FBI had told the Secret Service about Oswald's activities in Dallas. This was turning out to be a fateful discussion. In fact, it was another one of those sliding door moments in the story of Kennedy conspiracism. Until they noticed these gaping holes in the FBI report, the Warren commissioners had assumed that their inquiry was going to be a relatively simple, hands-off job. They'd been assuming that all the hard investigative work could safely be left to agencies like the FBI and the CIA. They thought that all that they would need to do was read the reports of those agencies and compare their conclusions. But the FBI report was so obviously superficial and half-baked that the commissioners knew there was no way they could accept its conclusions with a clear conscience. They were going to have to rethink their role and beef up their own powers. They would need to appoint their own investigative staff and reinvestigate the assassination from scratch. This meant that they would need to see all the raw materials that the FBI had based its report on. So Warren moved a motion to request these raw materials, and his motion was unanimously carried. "I think we ought to have the autopsy documents," John McCloy added. Considering the song and dance that conspiracy theorists made about Kennedy's autopsy over the following decades, it seems almost unbelievable that the Warren Commission didn't even think of looking at the autopsy documents until the incompetence of the FBI forced its hand. And this wasn't the only fateful thing that happened at this December the 16th meeting of the Warren Commission. At a certain point, the discussion turned or returned to the ongoing problem of the press leaks. Earl Warren said, quote, "Gentlemen, to be very frank about it, I have read that FBI report two or three times, and I have not seen anything in there yet that has not been in the press." "I couldn't agree with that more," said Dick Russell. "Practically everything in there has come out in the press at one time or another, a little bit here and a little bit there." As for where these leaks were coming from, Earl Warren reminded the other commissioners of what Nicholas Katzenbach had said at their first meeting about that earlier press leak. As Warren recalled, quote, "Senator Russell asked Katzenbach where it could have come from, and he said, there is only one source." Warren didn't say Hoover's name out loud here, and nobody else did either, but they all knew who they were talking about. This press leak prompted the commissioners to make another fateful policy decision. They resolved that until their final report was complete, they wouldn't release any evidence to the public or make any interim statements. In effect, they took a vow of silence because they feared that piecemeal releases of information were starting to confuse the public. And they resolved to impose this vow of silence on every other government agency too, or at least to try. They asked President Johnson not to release the FBI report to the American people, even though he'd promised that he was going to. This backflip caused Johnson some embarrassment, but he had no choice but to take his own commission's advice. When J. Edgar Hoover found out that the Warren Commission had blocked the release of his report, his loathing of the commission went to a whole new level. He was also incensed by a remark that Earl Warren made to the press when a reporter asked him why the FBI report was now not going to be released. Warren said that releasing the report would, quote, "serve no purpose. You understand," he explained, that the reports we are receiving are only summary reports of what happened in more or less skeleton form, and in order for us to evaluate them, we will need to see some of the materials upon which those reports are based. That is a normal thing. J. Edgar Hoover took a childish kind of revenge after those unflattering remarks appeared in the newspapers. When the commission asked to see all the FBI's raw materials, Hoover bombarded it with irrelevant paperwork. As he instructed his lieutenants, quote, "I want all reports, whether of substantial nature or so-called nut reports, to be sent to the commission. I want nothing to be withheld, irrespective of what the volume might amount to. Since the Chief Justice has asked for it, we should give it to him." Again, it's hard to exaggerate how irresponsible Hoover was being here. Kennedy's murder had dealt a staggering blow to America's spirit, and the Warren Commission was doing its best to put together a complete and transparent account of what had happened. And Hoover not only wasn't going to help the commission, he was actively going to hinder it. He was going to lie to it and leak against it and bury it under a mudslide of useless documents. And this is a man who saw himself as the chief protector of American decency, the man who prided himself on rooting out un-American activities, at least when they were being committed by other people. In an earlier episode of this podcast, when I was giving a minute-by-minute rundown of Oswald's movements on the day of the assassination, I said that when the time came, I would explain how we know what we know about Oswald. Well, it's fair to say that about 90 to 95% of the facts we know about Oswald and about all the other aspects of the assassination were established by the painstaking work of the Warren Commission. Vincent Bugliosi wrote that the Warren Commission's investigation, quote, has to be considered the most comprehensive investigation of a crime in history. And if we leave war crimes out of the equation, I think there's no question that Bugliosi was right. The Warren Commission took 9.5 months to complete its investigation. It took testimony from around 550 witnesses and entered over 3,000 exhibits into evidence. Its legal staff did an incredible amount of legwork to gather all that information, and they then did an admirable job of rational thinking when they sat down to construct a coherent account of the assassination that fitted together all the most reliable pieces of evidence they'd collected. The Commission's final written report was 888 pages long. A couple of months after it appeared, the Commission published 26 companion volumes of hearings and exhibits, containing things like photographs, document reproductions, and transcripts of all the witness testimony, as well as such obscure pieces of evidence as a microphotograph of Oswald's pubic hairs and a dental chart of Jack Ruby's mother's teeth. The Warren Report and its 26 companion volumes ran to a total of 16,000 pages, and all the best writers about the assassination have acknowledged that they're standing on the shoulders of the Warren Commission. In a way, even the conspiracy theorists are standing on the Warren Commission's shoulders too, because nearly all the conspiratorial works that have appeared since the publication of the Warren Report have been framed as a critique of it. The typical pattern of these books is to attack the Commission's conclusions by quoting testimony or evidence that the Commission itself collected and published in its companion volumes for everyone to see. Whatever we think of the Warren Commission's work in retrospect, though, it does have to be said that at the time, in the heat of the moment, the Commission's investigation had one enormous thing wrong with it. Precisely because that investigation was so meticulous, it took an eternity to complete. Kennedy was shot in November 1963, and the Commission's report didn't come out till September 1964. That's the best part of a year, and that was an excruciatingly long time to wait for a definitive answer to a question that struck many people as the most important question in the world. And this problem was compounded by that early decision the commission made to release no evidence or interim statements until its work was fully done. On paper, that might have been a sound decision, but in practice, it was the commission's biggest mistake. The commission was the most responsible and knowledgeable authority working on the Kennedy case, but for 9.5 months, it removed itself from the conversation. Meanwhile, other people who were far less knowledgeable and scrupulous were only too happy to step into the vacuum and flood the zone with bullshit. J. Edgar Hoover got many things wrong about the Kennedy case, but one thing he got right about it was that the American people wanted to hear some answers fast. When something as cataclysmic as the Kennedy assassination happens, it isn't in our nature to sit tight and wait patiently for 9.5 months until a high-quality, well-documented explanation becomes available. If high-quality answers aren't available to us, low-quality answers are far better than no answer at all. Back at the start of this episode, we heard J. Edgar Hoover warning that the Kennedy case would become a three-ring circus if the Senate and the House were allowed to conduct their own separate inquiries. But during the 9.5 month period when the Warren Commission was silently going about its work, a three-ring circus is exactly what the case became. One of the three rings was occupied by the Warren Commission. Or rather, it wasn't occupied by the Warren Commission. Their ring of the circus was empty because they were off behind closed doors, completing their investigation no matter how long it took. The commission stubbornly maintained its vow of silence during this period. It didn't release any interim reports or make any interim statements, and it didn't leak. This policy was designed to stop the public from becoming confused, but as the commission's long silence dragged on, public confusion was in fact drastically mounting. There were times when the commission could actually have reduced that confusion by releasing some of the evidence or making an interim statement, but still it refused to say anything. One of the people stoking the public confusion during this time was J. Edgar Hoover. He was the ringmaster of the second ring of the circus, and Hoover was a far less qualified ringmaster than he believed himself to be, because he was deeply confused himself. He thought he knew all the facts about the assassination, but a lot of what he thought he knew was junk. And he kept leaking that junk to the press under the impression that it was gold. Since his leaks were anonymous, Hoover was a kind of silent ringmaster. He might have been controlling the assassination story through the newspapers, but the public didn't know that he was the one doing it. As far as the public could see, nobody was talking openly about the assassination except the conspiracy theorists. By default, they became the authority on the case during that long period of official silence. They were the third ring of the circus, and their ring was the one where all the visible action was happening. Christopher Hitchens once said that a conspiracy theory is better than no theory at all. And that rule was massively confirmed in the 9.5 months after the Kennedy assassination. Conspiracy theorists had the arena pretty much to themselves, and at least they were offering people some kind of story. When the Warren Report finally appeared, the story it offered had the merit of being true and of being comprehensively supported by the evidence, but the fact would always remain that the Warren Commission's story came second, by quite a long way. By the time the Warren Report was published, many of the myths created by the conspiracy theorists had taken root. A lot of people had fallen in love with those myths, and they didn't want to give them up. Conspiracy theory got the jump on the Warren Report by almost a year, and in a way, the truth about the assassination has been trying to catch up with the myths ever since. So if the conspiracy theorists were running the circus during that 9.5 month period, who was the ringmaster of their show?
I am certain that if the case were tried based upon the facts which were
submitted to the public on November 24th by District Attorney of Dallas, there could have been no conviction. There clearly was not a case which indicated that Oswald was guilty beyond a reasonable doubt based upon everything that Mr. Wade said. There were, in my view, large numbers of unanswered questions at that time.
That's a New York attorney named Mark Lane. If Lee Harvey Oswald was the Jesus Christ of Kennedy conspiracy theory, then Mark Lane was about to become the movement's leading apostle. Lane was 35 years old at the time of Kennedy's death. On the night of the assassination, he was watching his TV when the disheveled Oswald was hauled before the cameras for his midnight press conference at Dallas City Hall. As a defense lawyer, Lane said later, I saw a guy and I thought he might be telling the truth when he said he didn't know anything. He seemed really bewildered. Whether Mark Lane actually believed that was another question. In New York, Lane was already known as a remorseless self-publicist, and he had a track record of using unscrupulous methods in the pursuit of supposedly worthy causes. He'd recently served a 2-year term in the New York State Assembly as a reform Democrat. JFK himself had endorsed Lane's campaign in 1960. In fact, there's a promotional photo of the two men posing together during Lane's campaign. Lane is wearing his trademark horn-rimmed glasses. He looks like Clark Kent, and Kennedy looks like Superman. Lane won his election, but wound up serving only a single 2-year term. He spent most of those 2 years running a noisy but unsuccessful campaign to get the Speaker of the Assembly dismissed for a supposed conflict of interest. When the Assembly's Ethics Committee investigated Lane's allegations, it slammed him for having given, quote, wide publicity to a most serious charge against a public official without a shred of credible evidence to sustain it. And when the full Assembly, Republicans and Democrats, met to consider the findings of the Ethics Committee, they endorsed its verdict by a vote of 143-1. And guess who cast that single dissenting vote? The New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller said at the time that there was something ruthlessly misleading about Lane's intellectual style. By November 1963, Lane was out of state politics. But when Kennedy was assassinated, and when Oswald was murdered in police custody, Lane suddenly saw a whole new opportunity for himself. He decided to cast himself as Oswald's de facto public defense attorney, at least insofar as a dead man can have an attorney. In the days after Oswald's death, Lane wrote a 10,000-word document he called Oswald Innocent, a Lawyer's Brief. Lane tried to get this published in a number of prominent newspapers and magazines, including the New York Post and Life magazine, but they all rejected it. Lane wasn't put off, though. He started sending the article to a bunch of less reputable papers instead, in the hope that one of them would eventually say yes. He also sent an advance copy to Earl Warren, and he attached a fairly aggressive covering letter saying that if the Warren Commission wanted to be taken seriously, it would be needing to appoint a legal counsel to represent Oswald's interests. Lane didn't come right out and nominate himself for that job, at least not yet, and he wasn't too impressed by the Warren Commission's reply to his letter. They sent him a stock blow-off note, not even signed by Warren himself, which assured Lane that his views would be given appropriate consideration. It was almost as if the Warren Commission didn't know who Mark Lane was. They seemed to have mistaken him for just some guy. On November the 19th, not quite 3 weeks after Kennedy's death, Lane's 10,000-word defense brief for Oswald finally appeared in print in an obscure radical newspaper called the National Guardian. Shortly after Lane's article was published, somebody showed a copy to Oswald's mother, Marguerite. In early January, Marguerite Oswald finally took the hint and asked Mark Lane to act as her late son's attorney.
He arrived in Fort Worth during the weekend, and I asked him if he would represent my son, Lee Harvey Oswald, at the Warren Commission hearing and in the investigation. I explained to him that I would not be able to pay him now. True to my sense of justice, Mr. Lane immediately replied that he had never turned down a case yet because there was no fee, and that it was too late to start bad habits now.
Now that Oswald's mother had officially retained his services, Lane wrote to the Warren Commission again and formally applied to represent Oswald at its proceedings. But again, the commission blew Lane off. It informed him that it was, quote, a fact-finding agency, and that since Oswald wasn't on trial, he wouldn't be needing an attorney. But the commission did invite Lane to appear before it as a witness. Lane ended up testifying to the Warren Commission twice, but he never forgave it for denying him a formal role. As the commission silently went about its work, Lane took his case directly to the people. He wrote a lecture called Who Killed Kennedy, and he delivered it on a nightly basis in a succession of New York theatres, charging adults $2 a pop for entry and students 99 cents, with profits going to a kind of Oswald defence fund that Lane called the Citizens Committee of Inquiry. In the summer of 1964, Lane took his lecture tour on the road to Europe. In London, he made a big impression on Bertrand Russell, the most famous philosopher in the world, and Russell was inspired to set up the British Who Killed Kennedy Committee. Russell persuaded quite a few heavy-hitting British intellectuals to join his committee, including the historian Hugh Trevor Roper and the critic Kenneth Tynan. By the time the Warren Report was published in September 1964, Mark Lane had established himself as the breakout star of the Oswald Innocence Project. His 1966 book, Rush to Judgment, was the first mass-market hardback in the genre of Kennedy conspiracism, and it spent 2 months at the top of the New York Times bestseller list. In Europe and the United States, Lane became a fixture on TV talk shows. He always looked serenely sure of himself in his horn-rimmed glasses, striking an endless series of fresh matches to relight his fuming pipe, and talking a blue streak of hot bollocks.
Now, I examined that rifle when I testified before the commission. I don't know very much about foreign weapons. I know a little bit about American Army weapons, but it's a foreign weapon. But at once I knew it was not a German Mauser 7.65 millimeters, because in large, clear letters, it said on it, "Made Italy, caliber 6.5. The commission implies that Weitzman must be some kind of a fool, and one, assuming he's a Dallas policeman, might accept that too quickly, but...
Lane never shut up about the Kennedy assassination, and he had an ability to say anything with a straight face. Not every early Kennedy conspiracy theorist was as opportunistic and shady as Mark Lane was. In fact, he was the most dishonest of the early conspiracy theorists by a long way. But precisely because he was such a charlatan and such a blowhard, Lane had no real competition as the ringmaster of early conspiracy theory. He did far more than any other single person to get the rocket of Oswald denialism up off the ground and into orbit, even though it was propelled by nothing but hot air. The American professor Cass Sunstein, who is a very useful analyst of conspiracy theory, talks about a figure he calls the conspiracy entrepreneur. The conspiracy entrepreneurs are the people in conspiracy theory who know exactly what they're doing. They're the people who very deliberately harness conspiracy theory in order to use it for their own profit or publicity. Mark Lane was the first conspiracy entrepreneur in the Kennedy case. But if Lane's conspiratorial shtick was so bogus, why did it go down so well with audiences? The answer is that from the moment Kennedy was shot, many thousands of people instinctively felt that there had to be more to the assassination than met the eye, and they were actively shopping around for reasons to justify that belief. And that's what Lane seemed to be offering, reasons to believe, to understand why Kennedy conspiracism caught on so spectacularly well. We have to acknowledge that right from the start there was a huge demand for the brand of snake oil that people like Mark Lane were selling. But of course that only raises the deeper question of where this demand came from. Why was there such a widespread urge to disbelieve the lone assassin story? It was a strange urge, and the visible facts of the crime didn't really explain it. At one level, the urge was almost spiritual. Kennedy's death was the most shocking psychological blow that Americans had suffered since the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And the idea that such a huge injury could have been inflicted by a scrawny geek like Oswald was extremely hard to accept. It just didn't add up. As Norman Mailer once put it, if such a non-entity destroyed the leader of the most powerful nation on Earth, then a world of disproportion engulfs us, and we live in a universe that is absurd. At a gut level, many people rebelled against that sense of disproportion. They felt that there had to be a hidden truth behind Kennedy's murder that was as large and evil as the crime's effects. Mark Lane was ready to reassure these doubters that their gut feelings were right. The universe wasn't absurd. The real story behind the assassination was larger and more interesting than Lee Harvey Oswald. There was another sense, too, in which Oswald failed to meet people's expectations as an assassin. He wasn't just a non-entity. He was a left-wing non-entity. He was a Marxist. And this gave a lot of people a political reason to hope that Oswald wasn't the true culprit. It's been said, I think correctly, that if Oswald had been a right-winger, the conspiracy theories about Kennedy's murder would never have got off the ground, because a right-wing assassin shooting a liberal president would have made much more political sense. But for a lot of people, the idea that a left-wing assassin had taken out a liberal president just didn't compute. People who were left-wingers themselves found it particularly hard to swallow. Many of them found it more convenient to imagine that Kennedy had been knocked off by a conspiracy of right-wingers, Southern racists, Texan oil men, the CIA, the military-industrial complex, or perhaps all of them acting together. Political beliefs have always played a large role in shaping American conspiracy theories. After the bombing of Pearl Harbor, a faction of the American right claimed that the whole thing had been an inside job. They'd always believed that President Franklin Roosevelt was a dangerous socialist, and now they were ready to believe, or to say they believed, that Roosevelt had known about the Japanese attack in advance and had let it happen so that he could trick Congress into approving America's entry into the Second World War. A similar thing happened after the attacks of 9/11, although the political logic was reversed. This time, a right-wing president was in the White House, and progressive conspiracy theorists thought it was pretty clever to say that George Bush and Dick Cheney had brought down the Twin Towers themselves to trick Americans into supporting the war on terror. Because Kennedy conspiracy theory has been around for 60 years now, the left-wing origins of the belief system have been largely forgotten. These days, people who believe in a Kennedy conspiracy come from both the left and the right, but in the early days, most of the active conspiratorial writers and thinkers were liberals at least, and a few of them were outright communists, and the people who bought their books tended to come from the political left as well. It's no accident that Kennedy conspiracy theory really took off as a mainstream phenomenon in 1966 and 1967, when opposition to the war in Vietnam was also taking off. At that stage, it was becoming increasingly clear to the American public that the Johnson administration was telling lies about the situation in Vietnam, and if it was lying about Vietnam, then maybe it had lied about the Kennedy assassination too. We do need to look to external factors like these to understand why the myth of Oswald's innocence spread like wildfire at that time, because it sure as hell didn't catch on because it made any intrinsic kind of sense. There's a useful book about conspiracy theory called Voodoo Histories by the English journalist David Aronovich. In his chapter about the Kennedy case, Aronovich quotes a couple of very interesting entries that his mother made in her diary at the time of the assassination. Aronovich's mother was a card-carrying and quite famous member of the British Communist Party. Her name was Lavender Aronovich. The day after Kennedy's murder, when Oswald was still alive and in custody, Mrs. Aronovich wrote in her diary, quote, "Wonder if it is a frame-up. He is billed as having communist associations." The next day, after Oswald was shot, she wrote another entry, quote, "Kennedy's alleged assassin, now assassinated, more and more looks like a frame-up." So without leaving her chair, Lavender Aronovich was somehow able to work out that there was a conspiracy behind Kennedy's murder. And not just a small kind of conspiracy involving Oswald and a few other people. Somehow she knew that the whole thing had been a massive frame-up. Oswald wasn't involved at all. He was completely innocent. This was a pretty radical conclusion for Mrs. Aronovich to reach from her armchair without apparently knowing anything about the evidence. But in fact, she actually did know one thing about the evidence, which was that Oswald was a communist, or was said to be a communist. For Lavender Aronovich, that was all the data you needed to work out that Oswald had been framed. In her mind, there could apparently be no such thing as a guilty communist. I've pointed out a few times in this podcast that two basic kinds of conspiracy can be imagined in the Kennedy case. The first is a conspiracy that Oswald was knowingly involved in. He did shoot Kennedy, but he had help from other people. The second kind of conspiracy you can imagine is a conspiracy that Oswald wasn't knowingly involved in, a conspiracy that used him as a completely innocent fall guy. In other words, you can imagine a guilty Oswald conspiracy, and you can imagine an innocent Oswald conspiracy. By definition, the guilty Oswald conspiracy is way more likely to have occurred than the innocent Oswald conspiracy, because to believe in a guilty Oswald conspiracy, you don't have to ignore the tsunami of evidence that proves that Oswald was unquestionably involved in Kennedy's shooting. And yet the weird paradox of Kennedy conspiracism is that over the years, conspiracy theorists have been almost completely uninterested in the more likely of these two scenarios. Instead of pursuing the somewhat plausible claim that Oswald may have had help, conspiracy theorists have overwhelmingly preferred to embrace the absurd fantasy that he didn't do anything at all. For some reason, they've decided to conduct a 60-year assault on Mount Impossible, and they've had almost no interest in trying to climb Mount Vaguely Plausible. On the face of it, this is an odd mystery, but in the diary of Lavender Aronovich, I think we can see a possible solution to the mystery. Given that she was a communist herself, Mrs. Aronovich had to believe in the Oswald was innocent kind of conspiracy. She had no other option. She was hardly likely to believe in a conspiracy involving a guilty Oswald, because that would have been a communist conspiracy, and from her point of view, that would have been even worse than the idea that Oswald had acted alone. So as a communist, Mrs. Aronovich had no choice but to reach for the brass ring. She had to believe that Oswald was completely innocent and had been framed. This was an astounding thing to believe on the basis of zero evidence, but Lavender Aronovich was far from being the only person on the left who made this leap of faith at the time. Millions of people made it, and they certainly weren't all card-carrying communists. And to be fair, there were historical reasons why so many left-leaning people had this paranoid reaction to the assassination. The previous couple of decades had been a rough time for the left, especially in America. In the 1940s, there were the Red Scares and the Hollywood blacklists, and the House Un-American Activities Committee, spearheaded by a young Richard Nixon, had hounded and persecuted a lot of imagined subversives and traitors, along with a few real ones, and had destroyed a lot of people's careers. In the early 1950s, the crusade against the communist menace had been taken up by the dreaded Senator Joseph McCarthy, chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations. And both Nixon and McCarthy, by the way, had been eagerly assisted in their efforts by J. Edgar Hoover, who was an arch anti-communist himself. When John F. Kennedy beat Richard Nixon in the 1960 presidential election, the American left could have been forgiven for thinking that their long nightmare was finally over. And then Kennedy was shot dead in broad daylight. Left-wingers could hardly be blamed for instinctively concluding that Kennedy had been murdered by a right-wing bigot. The fact that he'd been murdered by a left-wing bigot was almost too bitterly ironic to accept, so a lot of people didn't accept it. They preferred to believe in fantasies. Either Oswald wasn't a real communist, or he hadn't committed the crime, or possibly both. Not every left-leaning thinker in America became a conspiracy theorist, of course. Some liberal thinkers deplored the conspiracy theories about Kennedy's murder. The great progressive journalist I.F. Stone wrote at the time, quote, "All my adult life as a newspaper man, I have been fighting in defense of the left and of a sane politics against conspiracy theories of history. Now I see elements of the left using these same tactics in the controversy over the Kennedy assassination. It is one thing to analyze discrepancies," Stone went on. "It's quite another to write and speak in just that hysterical and defamatory way that the left has suffered over the last quarter century or more of political controversy." In other words, Kennedy conspiracy theory was a kind of left-wing revenge for the right-wing Red Scares of the 1940s and 50s. If people like Joseph McCarthy had used hysterical tactics against the left, then the left, or elements of the left, as I.F. Stone put it, were now guilty of using the same hysterical tactics in the debate about Kennedy's assassination. Interestingly, Stone singled out Mark Lane for special mention here. He castigated Lane for the, quote, "misinformation and poppycock" that he'd been spreading about the case. Lane was a bit of an outlier, though, because he knew he was talking poppycock. The more typical left-wing conspiracy theorist sincerely believed that Oswald was an innocent man who had been scapegoated for his political beliefs. Some of these true believers knew exactly what it was like to be persecuted by the American government because they'd been targeted themselves during the Red Scares. Some of them had even lost their jobs.
The commission began with a preconception that there was a lone nut assassin. His name was Lee Harvey Oswald. And it is clear that the commission was determined to do what it could to lend credibility to their preconception of political nature that Oswald was the lone assassin.
That's Harold Weisberg, who wrote an influential book about the assassination called Whitewash. Weisberg had worked for the U.S. State Department until 1947, when he was fired for allegedly associating with communists.
I think that the evidence clearly demonstrates that Oswald was entirely innocent of this crime, and indeed of the two other crimes charged to him, the murder of Tippit and the alleged attack on General Walker.
That's another prominent early conspiracy theorist, Sylvia Marr. In the mid-1950s, Marr had been fairly aggressively harassed by a US government loyalty board while working for the World Health Organization. She wound up keeping her job, but her experience undoubtedly helped to shape her whole understanding of the Kennedy assassination. Like Harold Weisberg, Sylvia Marr instinctively saw Oswald not as a homicidal thug, but as a persecuted member of her own tribe. Right from the start, the Kennedy case was personal for writers like Sylvia Marr. Her book, Accessories After the Fact, which was published in 1967, was one of the most influential of the early Oswald is Innocent books. In her foreword to that book, Ma recalled the moment when she heard that Kennedy had died. She was at work, anxiously listening to the radio with a group of colleagues when the news broke. This is how Ma describes that moment. At 2:30 p.m., the voice on the radio said with solemn anguish, "The president is dead." Someone in the room screamed with shock and grief. Someone cursed the John Birch Society and its kind. "Don't worry," I said derisively. "You'll see, it was a communist who did it." End quote. I've read a lot of conspiratorial books about the Kennedy assassination, and as far as I know, Sylvia Marr holds the record for the earliest achievement in Oswald denialism. Even before she knew who Oswald was, even before she knew he was a Marxist, she was already prepared to declare that he was a patsy, because according to her, this was the sort of thing the American authorities always did. They pinned crimes on communists that the communists hadn't really committed. So this was the political climate that Mark Lane was operating in when he decided to cast himself as Oswald's leading public champion. Lane's 10,000-word defense brief for Oswald, published just 3 weeks after the assassination, was the founding document of Kennedy conspiracism. There were millions of people around the world who wanted to believe Oswald was innocent, and Lane seemed to be offering hard documentary proof that their intuitions were correct. Remember the title of his article. It was "Oswald Innocent, A Lawyer's Brief." All around the country, budding conspiracy theorists read Lane's article, or they read of it, and they were electrified. One of them, whose name was Shirley Martin, said later, "Mark Lane's article in the National Guardian gave us hope that what we believed, that something fishy happened in Dallas, was true." In a metaphorical sense, all conspiracy theorists act like defense attorneys, and the clients they choose to represent are always guilty, whether the client is Lee Harvey Oswald, or Muhammad Atta, or the Imperial Japanese Air Force. So conspiracy theorists are always using the same kinds of tactics and arguments that lawyers use when their clients are guilty. What makes Mark Lane so interesting is that he really did become Oswald's defense attorney with the formal permission of Oswald's mother. Lane literally was what most conspiracy theorists are, only metaphorically. He was the defense attorney for a guilty client. So it's worth inspecting a few of the arguments that Lane used in his defense brief for Oswald, because the tricks he used in that document are quite typical of the tricks that conspiracy theorists are always using to make their cases. Lane's defense brief consisted of 15 numbered points. It identified 15 places where the case against Oswald, as it then stood, seemed to be less than airtight. Here, for example, is part of Lane's 12th point, which was about the shooting of J.D. Tippit. Quote, "The Dallas authorities first said Tippit was shot in a movie theater. Later it was reported that he was shot on one street and, still later, on another street." Those two sentences tell us a lot about how flimsy the case for Oswald's innocence already was, just a few weeks out from Kennedy's assassination. To make it seem as if there were 15 good points to be made in Oswald's favour, Lane was already having to use some pretty devious lawyer's tricks. In this case, the trick came in Lane's second sentence. His first sentence was straightforward enough. "The Dallas authorities said that Tippit was shot in a movie theatre." But listen again to Lane's next sentence. Quote, "Later it was reported that he was shot on one street and, still later, on another street." Notice how Lane slips into the passive voice there. He doesn't tell us exactly who reported this information. Does he mean that it was the Dallas authorities who said that? Had they put out 3 separate reports about where Tippit was shot? If they had, you can bet your life that Lane would have said that directly, because that really would have been suspicious. Instead, Lane used vague and deliberately misleading language to make it sound like that's what happened. What really happened is obviously a different matter. Probably Lane had read a newspaper that initially misreported the name of the street Tippett had been shot on, and then corrected that mistake at a later date. Lane scrambled his language to make this sequence of events sound sinister, but actually it's perfectly normal for newspaper reporters to make honest mistakes when they're covering complicated events in real time. There's always a general movement from confusion to clarification when a big public disaster like the Kennedy assassination occurs. And it's quite telling that just 3 weeks out from the assassination, Lane was already having to burrow back into the chaos of the early press reports to make his case. He was having to resurrect points of confusion that the newspapers had already cleared up. In Lane's 12th point, you can see two things that would become hallmarks of Kennedy conspiracism: a reliance on low-quality evidence combined with a willingness to handle evidence in a dodgy and unethical way. And these two things are linked. They go hand in hand. When you want to believe something that isn't true, you have to be dishonest about the evidence, or at least handle it very sloppily, to make it seem like you've got a genuine case. The other thing that Lane accidentally draws our attention to in this point is the importance to conspiracy theory of the C word, confusion. There was a lot of early confusion in the Kennedy case, but when Lane wrote his defense brief, that early confusion was already starting to lift. And as it lifted, Oswald kept looking more and more guilty, not more and more innocent. So in retrospect, we can see that those confused early days of the case were really the golden age of Oswald denialism. This was as good as the idea of an innocent Oswald was ever going to look. And yet it still looked very thin and shaky, as Lane's defense brief demonstrated. Remember, this was the founding document of Kennedy conspiracy theory, and already Lane was having to use some pretty desperate kinds of artificial respiration to preserve and revive the early confusion. Again, this is a tactic that runs through all conspiracy theory. It's been used more recently by people who've claimed that atrocities like the Sandy Hook shootings or the 7/7 bombings in London were inside jobs. The people who believe such stuff are always plundering the earliest media reports for so-called evidence. They dig up tiny mistakes that some reporter or eyewitness made in the heat of the earliest moment, and they act as if those mistakes point the way to the hidden truth. Conspiracy theorists can't seem to make up their minds about the mainstream media. When it corrects its own mistakes, it's lying. It's spreading propaganda on behalf of the deep state. But when the media makes mistakes that the conspiracy theorists like the sound of, they suddenly find that it can be relied on to the hilt. Not all of the 15 points Mark Lane raised in his defense brief were as obviously flimsy as his 12th point. His 11th point, for example, seemed quite valid. It concerns something that really was an unsolved mystery, at least at the time. This mystery had to do with the disappearance of a taxi driver, a guy named Darrell Click. You might remember that around 15 minutes after the shooting of John F. Kennedy, Oswald took the first cab ride of his life. He jumped in a taxi in downtown Dallas, and he got the cabbie to drive him out to the suburb of Oak Cliff, where his apartment was. According to Mark Lane, the Dallas District Attorney Henry Wade couldn't seem to make up his mind about what the name of Oswald's taxi driver was. At a press conference on November the 24th, Wade appeared to say the taxi driver's name was Darrell Click. And yet, on November the 27th, as Lane wrote, it was conceded that Darrell Click did not drive a taxi cab in which Oswald was a passenger. When Darrell Click disappeared from the case, William Whaley appeared as the man who drove Oswald to Oak Cliff. There was no denying that what Lane said was factually true. After Henry Wade's press conference on November the 24th, newspapers around the country, including the New York Times, had indeed quoted Wade as saying that Oswald was driven to Oak Cliff by a taxi driver named Darrell Click. And Darrell Click's name had indeed vanished from the newspapers shortly after that and had been replaced by the taxi driver's real name, which was William Whaley. So who was Darrell Click and what had become of him? Like a lot of early questions about the Kennedy case, this one wasn't answered until 9 months later when the Warren Report was published. The report had an appendix called Theories and Rumours, which was specially written to address some of the talking points that conspiracy theorists like Mark Lane had been bandying around. The author of the Warren Report's Theories and Rumours chapter was an historian named Alfred Goldberg. When he was putting this chapter together, Goldberg became determined to solve the mystery of Darrell Click. So he got hold of a tape recording of Henry Wade's November the 24th press conference, and Goldberg said later that he had to listen to this recording about 75 times before the answer to the riddle suddenly occurred to him. Darrell Click was a phantom. He had never existed. I'm going to play you the same recording that Goldberg listened to. See if you can hear the answer that suddenly leapt out to him.
The bus, he asked the bus driver to stop, got off at a stop, called a taxi cab driver.
Where?
In Oak Cliff. I don't have the exact place, and went to his home in Oak Cliff.
In case you didn't pick it up, what happened there was this. Henry Wade said that Oswald, quote, caught a taxi cab driver. A reporter interrupted him and said, where? And Wade replied, in Oak Cliff. I don't have the exact place. Whoever transcribed this exchange for the newspapers must have been thrown by Wade's Texan accent, because when Wade said, in Oak Cliff, the stenographer wrote down Darrell Click. That mistake was faithfully reproduced in several big newspapers, including the New York Times, and from there it found its way into the work of conspiracy theorists like Mark Lane. For 9 months, it remained a reasonably useful conspiratorial talking point until the Warren Report finally put it out of its misery. Again, this kind of thing often happens in conspiracy theory. I call it the Darrell Click effect. The lesson of the Darrell Click episode is never underestimate the power of the cock-up in human affairs. Don't make the paranoid assumption that something has been done or said deliberately for nefarious reasons until you've eliminated the possibility that it's happened accidentally because of human incompetence. Conspiracy theorists are always assuming the worst of people, or rather, they're always assuming the worst about people's morals and motivations, while taking a very generous view of how competent people are. They think that human beings would have the competence to secretly murder a president and successfully cover that up for 60 years, when really we can't even transcribe the contents of a press conference without inventing a non-existent guy named Darrell. So when you put Mark Lane's defense brief for Oswald under the microscope, a pattern starts to emerge. The founding document of Kennedy conspiracism was, for the most part, just a mashup of cock-ups. It was a kind of collage made up of a lot of different tiny scraps of error and confusion that seemed to look good for Oswald. Mark Lane seemed to be gambling that these points of confusion would either never be cleared up, or that at least one of them would end up being clarified in Oswald's favour. And that should have happened at least once if Oswald was really innocent. But it never did. As the case's early mysteries and ambiguities were cleared up, not a single one of them ever panned out Oswald's way. Clarification is always the enemy of people who are wrong or guilty, and it certainly turned out to be the enemy of anyone who was looking to put together a lasting case for Oswald's innocence. When Mark Lane accepted Marguerite Oswald's request to represent her dead son, he did so on the condition that if he ever found evidence that Oswald was guilty, he would be free to change his mind and abandon Oswald's defence. Or anyway, that's what Lane and Mrs. Oswald told the public, and it sounded like a fairly high-minded stance. But as the months went by, and as the 15 points in Lane's defence brief melted into the air, Lane never did stop publicly claiming that Oswald was innocent. Even after Oswald's mother fired him, about 3 months after hiring him, Lane continued to be the public face of Oswald denialism. In fact, he kept up the act for the rest of his life. He died in 2016 at the age of 89. By that time, he'd written 4 different books about the assassination and 1 screenplay, and he'd tried to pin Kennedy's murder on pretty much anyone he could think of except Oswald. Somehow, Lane always managed to cling to his central claim that Oswald was innocent, even though his reasons for believing that claim kept changing. He was like a guy living in an improvised shack made out of random scraps of lumber and trash. One by one, these materials rotted away and were blown off in the wind. But instead of moving into a more sensible house made out of better materials, Lane just kept finding new chip wrappers and bits of cardboard to patch up the holes with. At the end of his long career, he was still living in what seemed to be the same shack, but if you looked at it up close, you could see that not a single piece of the original structure was still there. And a similar thing has happened with Kennedy conspiracy theory in general. Somehow the central belief, the belief that something fishy happened in Dallas, is still with us, even though all the earliest and best reasons for believing that shriveled away decades ago. The thesis has stayed the same, but the reasons for believing it have been in a constant state of flux. This is the kind of pattern you expect to see in a religious faith, not in a supposedly rational belief. If we ever catch ourselves thinking that there must be something to the belief that Oswald was innocent, just because that belief has survived for 60 years, we need to remind ourselves that all that's really survived is the shell of the belief. There's never been anything solid or permanent inside that shell. The substance of the belief has never arrived. In Mark Lane's case, this process of decay and mutation was already happening as early as August 1966 when he published his first book about the assassination, which was called Rush to Judgment. Almost none of the 15 pro-Oswald points that he'd raised in his lawyer's brief made it into his book. There's no mention of Darrell Click in there, for example. In the space of just 3 years, almost all the first arguments that Lane had advanced in Oswald's favour had aged so badly that even Lane could see they were no longer usable. And as we've seen, Lane's standards were far from strict. But by the time he wrote his book, Lane had found some shiny new arguments to replace his old ones. And to be fair to him, there was one point that he'd raised in his defence brief that did make it into the book. And it seemed to be quite a good point, too. In fact, it was the best point that Kennedy conspiracy theory would ever have. It was such a good point that even people who weren't conspiracy theorists found it very troubling. This point proved to be a particular problem for J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, and it caused the Bureau to commit an almost unbelievable series of Clouseau-esque blunders that played right into the hands of people like Mark Lane. The point concerned one of Kennedy's bullet wounds, a small and very controversial hole in the middle of his throat. This was the wound that launched 1,000 conspiracy theories, and we'll be talking about it next time on The Ghosts of Dallas.
The nature of the throat wound can no longer be verified, for no records were made and no pictures taken before Dr. Perry cut through it in an attempt to relieve his patient's breathing. The doctors at Parkland were engaged in a desperate struggle to keep the president alive. All else was secondary. But their task was impossible. One of the shots had virtually destroyed the president's head. Dr. Perry was rushed from the emergency room to a news conference where he was badgered into giving a description of the wounds. The neck wound, he told the press, looked like an entry wound, and he pointed to the front of his neck.